Okay, so the speaker today is Matteo Smerlach, and he's going to talk about black holes and reversibility. So please, Matteo, go ahead.
Great, good morning. It's a pleasure to talk today. If we directly move to slide 2, I can tell you what the setup of the discussion is going to be.
Can you get closer to the mic, please?
Okay, I'm speaking into the microphone, but I'm speaking really loud.
Okay, thank you.
Is it okay now? Yeah?
Yes, better.
The physical setup here in PI is not great, so I'm doing my best. You can interrupt if you can't hear me well. Okay, so the physical setup that is being considered here on slide number 2 is that of gravitational collapse, where a black hole forms from infalling matter, which might be classical matter, maybe a collapsing star, a massive star. And at some point in this process, a trapping or apparent horizon forms. And the consequence of this event is that outgoing geodesics start getting peeled off from this newborn trapping horizon. If the field was prepared in the vacuum at past infinity, at prime minus, then the coupling of the field with this geometrical structure, the trapping horizon, will induce a modification of the state of the field, which manifests itself as thermal Hawking radiation. The radiation that gets emitted escapes to future infinity, here denoted chi plus, where a time coordinate can be used, denoted u, and usually called retarded time. The temperature of this radiation is inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole that forms. And then, for a very long time, this process goes on. However, the question arises, because of the thermality of the flux that comes from the black hole, of a breakdown of predictability. It would seem at first sight that a pure state, the in state, is turned into a mixed state corresponding to thermal radiation. This is what Hawking himself called the breakdown of predictability in the Hawking process, in the evaporation process, and this is the topic of the talk. So we can move to slide number 3, where I'd like to frame the information loss problem, the problem that I just formulated, as a physical problem rather than a principle problem. It is usually stated that information loss violates a basic tenet of quantum mechanics, which preserves purity of state. This is what is meant by unitary evolution. However, I want to stress that information loss is a physical process that happens all the time, in particular for quantum systems that couple to an open environment. This is what is known as decoherence, but also in a geometric framework, whenever the out state is evaluated on a surface that is not a Cauchy surface. This is a point that Bob Wolf has made again and again recently. And he gave this example of a hyperboloid in the future that is not a Cauchy surface and on which the in state turns out not to be pure, but mixed. So from that perspective, information loss is not exceptional. It is something that happens in some circumstances. The question is, what are the physical consequences? So one possible physical consequence has been discussed in the 80s by Banks, Peskin, and Sutkind. And that would be a terrible messing up of this transformation of pure states into mixed states with conservation laws, in particular energy and momentum conservation laws. This is an argument that is being cited over and over again. However, it was debunked by Unruh and Walt more than 10 years ago in a paper that showed that you can have decoherence or loss of purity without energy being involved in the process. So this is something that we should keep in mind. By itself, it is not true, it is not the case that information loss messes up with conservation law. So as far as we are concerned, I would say that the only real question is, what is the difference whether information is lost or not lost in physical terms? Can we identify or predict physical effects that would relate to the information loss problem rather than focusing on principle issues like relating to basic tenets of quantum mechanics and so on? I recall that quantum mechanics was devised in the 20s to deal with atoms and molecules, and certainly not with black holes. And it is not by itself a problem that quantum mechanics would fail in this new situation, And so if we are going to have a problem with information loss, it will have to be a physical problem and not one that directly pertains to the basic tenets of quantum mechanics. Let's move on to the next slide, slide number 4, where I'm showing you the outline of the talk. In the first section, I'll discuss the physical behavior that is coined black hole evaporation, the physics of the Hawking process, using the notion of squeezed state. In the second section, I'll dig a little bit deeper into the main new feature of quantum mechanics in the case with respect to a classical process, and that's the entanglement of the past with the future. And in the final section, I'll discuss perhaps a slightly new perspective on information loss. So we can move to slide number 5, where I'm showing you what I think of as the Hawking effect. As seen from the perspective of observers that are standing far from the black hole, they are not aware of the presence of trapping horizons or event horizons or singularities. What they see is what they receive from the geometry in the box. So if one imagines that somebody would send in a spherical wave into the infalling matter with a given frequency, so a harmonic wave, and then wait to see what comes out, the first line in this picture is something that is depicting what would be observed. Such a classical ingoing wave would, on its way out from space-time, appear to be more and more dilated with a frequency that appears to be...
Hello. Yeah, this is Marseille. The sound is very, very bad here. Is there any way it can be improved on your side?
I'm trying. I'm almost shouting here, so this is probably the loudest I can make. Can you hear me, Carlo?
Yeah, now it's better. Okay. There was a lot of echo and noise. Maybe it's better now. Thank you.
Okay. So, I'll try again, and please stop again.
What happens is that you start out just like now, but after a while it fades. So there's something that you're doing in time.
Okay, I'll do my best. Thank you, Abhay. Okay, so this classical wave, as seen from an asymptotic observer, would appear to have its frequency getting lower and lower, and this is a direct consequence of gravitational time dilation in the neighborhood of the black hole, of the incumbent black hole. At the quantum level, the very same process appears to turn the initial vacuum, whose photon statistic is the one that you see on the left, no photon in any mode, into a new state, which is coined in the quantum optics literature a squeezed vacuum state, in which 1, 3, 5, and so on particle states are not occupied, but even number particle states are occupied, and those are the Hawking pairs that one usually refers to. Of course, the question is what happens next? And so this is what the question mark here represents. Moving on to the next slide, number 6. I'm showing you what a two-mode squeezed vacuum state looks like in terms of its wave function. So we can picture here a couple of harmonic oscillators, A and B, with position variables X, A, and B, and momentum variables P. So the position variables are on the left-hand side and the momentum variables on the right-hand side. And the Gaussian that we see on the first line is, of course, the vacuum state for the two-mode system. The second row corresponds to a squeezed state, a two-mode squeezed vacuum state, in which we see that the position of the two oscillators are more correlated than in the vacuum, and the momenta of the two oscillators are more anti-correlated than in the vacuum. So writing a state explicitly for this AB system, in this state we see an expansion in terms of number of particles, the same number of particles in both modes, and a decaying amplitude as the number of particles goes to infinity, which is given by the hyperbolic tangent of a number, R, called the squeezing parameter, and quantifying the squeezing, the actual geometric squeezing of the wave function in the diagram that you see at the top. Now, Such states have a feature, and that is that when one focuses on one of the two oscillators rather than the two and trace out the degrees of freedom associated to the second oscillator, one obtains a state that is exactly a thermal state with a Boltzmann factor which is directly given by the tanh of the squeezing parameter. And in particular, one finds that the stronger the squeezing, the higher the temperature as perceived in one of the two subsystems. This is the origin of the thermality of Hawking radiation. The black hole geometry is what produces the squeezing of the wave function. And the fact that particles are produced in pairs, but only one of the particles comes out to infinity where we observe it, implies that we are really dealing with the reduced state. And this state, for this reason here, is a thermal state. The temperature that's arising in this slide is the Hawking temperature. We can move on to the next slide, in which I just want to emphasize that producing and observing such states is current experimental activity involving various groups around the world in various types of different systems. The squid case here corresponds to the first observation of the so-called dynamical Casimir effect, which is a way to produce such squeezed vacuum states with a moving boundary, a moving mirror. And this was done very recently experimentally for the first time, and the correlations that I just mentioned were observed as signatures of this particular type of squeezed state. But there's also activity involving BECs, as well as nonlinear optics, hydrodynamics even in the UNRU group in Vancouver, and so on and so forth. And I take this activity as displaying the actuality of and the present nature of all problems pertaining to the Hawking effect, more so than buzzies we might have in our own theoretical communities. The fact that there is a larger world involved in trying to produce and measure those states, I think, testifies to the interest of the physical community as a whole for such phenomena.
Can I ask a question on this? Is I think that what you're saying on slides 5 and slides 6 is a little bit confusing to me, at least, because in slide 5 you said that the Hawking pairs, you only have these pairs, and odd number is, you know, the number of expected number of particles is 0 in the odd number of particles, and the even number is what he showed. So these are the pairs you talked about. In slide 6, you talk again about a pair, but this pair is completely different because the previous pair actually appears at null infinity, and this pair is something kind of, I mean, the previous pair was actually mathematically very precise, whereas a pair on slide 6, to me at least, is not mathematically precise because this is more physical heuristic picture of one particle falling into the horizon and one going to infinity. But in fact, what we find at infinity is pairs of particles and not one. So I think there is a little bit of a, I find it confusing, the two slides coming one after the other. The name, the meaning of the pair is quite different in the two slices, in the two slides.
Well, in my mind, they're the same pairs. The pairs that are produced in the Hawking process, and it's only one of them that escapes to infinity and that we see. And because of this disregarding of other modes that are probably falling into the black hole, we get to see the radiation as thermal radiation. In my mind, the pairs in both slides are the same pairs. Am I wrong about this, Abhay?
I think so, because in the, what is, I mean, in the transparency 5, the radiation we're talking, I mean, the Bogoliubov transformation gives you the outgoing state, right, to be exponential of a two-particle state, right? And so what we see at infinity is going to be the state which is the exponential of a two-particle state then traced over the horizon states. So we're still getting exponential of two-particle states out there. Okay, maybe we should just discuss this later.
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you.
Thank you, Abhay, for pointing this out anyway. So we are now on slide 8, where I'm writing down again the open questions with this problem. The main problem is that evaporation is really a runaway problem. I stress that the production of radiation implies the loss of mass by the black hole, which then means that the black hole will shrink, and so its surface gravity will get higher, meaning higher squeezing of the fields in its neighborhood, meaning more radiation and so forth and so on. And so this is clearly a runaway problem for which we should ask the following questions, I think. Does this lead to an explosive behavior like Hawking predicted back in the 70s? Should we expect the thermality of outgoing radiation to break down at some late times? Should we look for astrophysical signatures? And can we expect to see any of this in the near future? I think all of these questions are really interesting, and perhaps slightly less interesting are questions like, do black holes exist? Or is the evaporation process consistent with a duality involving ADS boundary conditions? Or is the Einstein-Rosen wormhole the same as the EPR entanglement phenomenon? All these questions, I think, are secondary, to say the least, with respect to the physical questions that are here. I'm just reminding this, at least for myself, because this is the direction I myself would like to take in investigating this problem. And I'll do my best in the remaining slides to try and address them, although the results are only very partial. Moving on to the next slide, slide number 9. Let's focus on this past-future entanglement problem, which is really the hallmark of the quantum nature of the evaporation process, and the one that requires our thorough attention, I would say. And so on slide 10, we see the situation we would have if we were considering a physical, finite-dimensional quantum system. Okay, so one measure of entanglement in finite systems is entanglement entropy, which is defined as the Fonneumann entropy of the reduced density matrix that you get when you trace out parts of a composite system, such as the AB pair of oscillators I was talking about before. And it has several properties, this measure. First of all, it's unitarily invariant. And second, it satisfies the triangle inequality that is written on the slide here, which means several things. First of all, if the composite system happens to be in a pure state, you see on the left that the entanglement entropy of A is the same as the entanglement entropy of B. It is a symmetric measure, in other words, of entanglement between subsystems. And so we should really think of it as measuring correlations between subsystems rather than something pertaining to A itself or B itself. And the fact that we have the right-hand side also implies that the entanglement entropy of one subsystem should have the behavior plotted in the graph here as a function of the size of one of the two subsystems. So if we consider a partition of AB into A and B, and the size of A can change, ranging from nothing to the whole system AB, we expect the entanglement entropy to have this up, then down behavior that is a direct consequence of the triangle inequality that I wrote here on this slide. Now, on slide 11, I'm showing you that this picture is indeed what is being conjectured to happen for Hawking radiation, at least by Don Page. So those are ideas coming back from the 90s, but revived in a recent paper, where he says we should expect this up then down behavior of the entropy S of Hawking radiation. In the first phase, the up phase, we have Hawking radiation coming out. This is the Hawking phase. But then as Hawking radiation becomes a larger and larger system until it eventually takes the whole composite system, there will be a maximum at a time that is now called the Page time. And then a decreasing phase for entanglement, which is referred to as a purification phase, a putative purification phase. Here on the x-axis, you see a letter T corresponding to time as measured by an asymptotic observer far from the black hole. If that observer is stationary and not moving relative to, say, a spherically symmetric black hole, that T would be the same as retarded time U that I introduced in a Penrose diagram earlier. Now, this curve here is really a conjecture, And it could be argued that verifying or checking this conjecture is one of the outstanding problems in quantum black hole physics. And so I'd like to focus our attention on this curve. Moving on to slide 12, let me formulate three different open questions. One of them is the classic question, namely, is the evaporation process unitary, meaning is the purity of the sealed state preserved in the evaporation process? So should we expect in particular the quantum entropy of the state of radiation at, say, future infinity to be the same as the entropy of the same field at past infinity? That this might not be the case was Hawking's proposal in the breakdown of predictability paper in 76.
Okay.
There's a different question which we can also ask, and that's the question of what I call cyclicity, meaning should we expect entanglements between the past and the future in the field state to be the same in the asymptotic future and in the asymptotic past? So in particular, should we expect the page curve that was on the previous slide to be a good approximation, namely in its starting from the zero, from some zero reference value, and ending up at the end of the evaporation process at the same value? So I call this behavior cyclic in reference to cyclic thermodynamic transformations where we take a system, transform it, and eventually bring it back to the very state it was initially. Now, of course, for finite dimensional systems, unitarity and cyclicity are pretty much the same. That's what I said two slides ago. But in quantum field theory, it might not be the case. And so I want to distinguish the notion of unitarity and the notion of cyclicity. And another question we should ask and keep in mind is that of the conservative nature of the evaporation process, namely asking, is the output of energy coming from the evaporation process the same as the input of energy that goes into forming the black hole in the first place? Should we expect the Bondi mass of the black hole to go down to zero at as U goes to plus infinity? So those are three different questions whose interrelationship is especially interesting in this problem. We can move on to slide 13. So I can spell out the working assumption in this talk to address those questions. Consists in reducing the field dynamics to an effectively two-dimensional problem. And what that means physically is that angular momentum of both space-time and fields is neglected. So by this I mean that I consider spherically symmetric space-times, but also fields in their S-wave sector. Backscattering is neglected so that conformal techniques can be used. But on the other hand, semi-classical back reaction, the notion that the effective space-time geometry might be really different at some point from a Schwarzschild geometry, this is included as a possible feature of the process. So all in all, this means that the field dynamics, which would be 3 plus 1 dimensional, is effectively reduced to a 2D CFT. Corresponding to the time radius sector of space-time. Now, on slide 14, I'm showing you how a notion of entanglement entropy in quantum field theory can be defined in this setup. The first thing to say, of course, is that entanglement entropy, unlike the finite dimensional case, is not well defined because it's UV divergent. There are modes with arbitrarily high frequencies in the field, and those modes all contribute to the entropy. So entanglement entropy by itself is UV divergence, and so one route to make sense of this notion is to subtract vacuum contribution. So that's what I'm showing here. If we suppose that we consider a state psi of the field and split it in two subsystems, one that might correspond to the field up until a retarded time U, and everything that comes after is excluded, so that corresponds to early radiation, one can say, and subtract the contribution of homogeneous Minkowski vacuum states up until that very same time U, we get a measure of excess entanglement in the state psi with respect to the reference state vacuum. So this was called renormalized entanglement entropy by these authors in 94, and their contribution to the field has been really seminal, as I'll show next. And so, just let me state that on the slide 14, there's a typo, of course. What I'm doing here is defining an entropy function of U by subtracting the phoneme entropy of the reduced state up until time U in the state psi and in the state vacuum. This defines renormalized entanglement entropy. So on slide 15, I recall the formula that was obtained by Holsey, Larsen, and Wolczak in 94 for the entanglement entropy of a segment in 1 plus 1 dimension. And so using some transformations and manipulations that I'm skipping today for this talk, the next line shows you the results that Eugenio Bianchi and myself obtained for the entanglement entropy in excess of the vacuum at some time u. It's given by this formula here, where the chi factor is the in-out redshift factor, which can be defined by considering a wave that goes into spacetime with a frequency omega minus, and then comes back from it with a different frequency omega plus, and chi is just the ratio of these frequencies. So with these manipulations, we get a geometric formula that directly relates the spacetime geometry of a black hole, of an incipient black hole, with the entanglement in the field as perceived by asymptotic observers. Now, on the next slide, slide 16, I'm showing you how, using this formula, one can compute the excess entanglement entropy at scry plus on a given background. So the approach here is take a spacetime, an entire spacetime, and compute the redshift of that spacetime and evaluate entropy from that redshift. So it's an approach where we start from a putative spacetime and get an entropy curve out of it. So in this case here, I'm showing the formation of a black hole with a Vidae spacetime. So it's a null shell that collapses and forms a black hole, corresponding to the red region here with a space-like singularity in the future, and a Schwarzschild patch outside of that shell. Now, because in this spacetime redshift can be computed exactly through ray tracing operations, one can get an exact formula for the excess entanglement entropy as a function of retarded time. This is the curve that you see. Starts from zero because that's the path. That's when the field is not different from the Minkowski vacuum. And then has a transient turnaround behavior and starts growing linearly with time. So you have the exact expression here with m, the mass of the collapsing shell, and w, a special function called the Lambert function, which asymptotes to a linear curve here with a coefficient that's inversely proportional to the mass, or in other words, proportional to the Hawking temperature of this black hole. So I'm showing you this computation just to show how one can begin to get to grips with the entanglement entropy formula on a given background. On slide 17, I'm showing you a different background where instead of having a stationary black hole, we have a black hole that eventually disappears. And so here we have an ad hoc procedure where we undo the black hole by sending a negative mass shell at advanced time V1, which has the effect of removing the singularity. And in this spacetime as well, just for the sake of illustrating the notion of redshift and its influence on entropy, we see that the disappearance of the singularity produces a last ray, the dashed line that goes to future infinity. And on this last ray here, we find that entanglement entropy, excess entanglement entropy, diverges logarithmically. And so this is a scenario that Hawking and others, Stewart in particular, coined a thunderbolt. I'm not showing you this diagram as a prediction, but rather as, again, an illustration of the relationship between space-time geometry and field entanglement. So on slide 18, I'm summarizing once more the approach. One can go on and compute entanglement entropy for more space-time, more dynamical space-times, a larger number of them, And this will illustrate deeper the connection between geometry and entanglement, and this is what you can find in a paper with Eugenio Bianchi and Tommaso De Lorenzo. But I want to stress that in this approach, where we start from space-time to get entropy, back reaction is an input. One starts from a guess for the dynamical structure of space-time, and from then, one computes entanglement entropy. And I would say this is really the next best thing after a blind guess of the Page curve, of the entanglement entropy curve. And so I think it's important that we try and figure out another, perhaps less narrow approach, where one doesn't need to guess back reaction, but rather one would derive generic consequences for space-time itself of principles or constraints such as unitarity, cyclicity, or conservation of energy. And this is the purpose of the next section. So on slide 19, we move on to the next and final section of the talk, where it's about cyclic and acyclic processes. So on slide 20, I just want to recall that there is a different approach. There are a number of authors that have proposed that evaporation is non-unitary, at least in the effective quantum field theory sector. It's an idea that Unruh and Wolf discussed in 95, and Unruh discussed again recently in a 2012 paper. So here, the idea is that we can think of as the black hole as a bath, as an environment, which may not carry energy in its degrees of freedom. It would be something like a spin bath, and the field would couple to that spin bath in a way that would decohere the state of the field without violating any energy conservation principle. This idea has been developed and elaborated by Alejandro Perez recently. The idea here would be that the spin bath is really quantum gravity degrees of freedom. So we can expect the coupling of infalling Hawking particles into the black hole with quantum gravity to produce space-time defects. So this is the A bar symbol that you see on the diagram on the right. A defect in space-time, a defect in the space-time weave, and that defect would be entangled with outgoing radiation and explain the non-unitarity of the evaporation itself, of the state of the field, the evolution of the state of the field in the quantum field theory sector. So those are possibilities, and there's no way I can rule them out, but I just want to explore another possibility here, which is unitary but acyclic evaporation. So on slide 21, I'm just giving you an example of a process which would be unitary but acyclic. This process consists in coupling the fields to a boundary. Think of it as a mirror, and that boundary would change its state of motion starting from some static state in the past and accelerating for a finite time until it becomes inertial with a relative velocity with respect to its initial state. So this effect, this behavior would have the effect of changing the redshift factor in space-time. So this is what we see here. If you consider the separation between two ingoing rays, in the past and in the future, in the outgoing region, that separation would be different due to the change of the state of motion of the boundary. So a quick computation shows that the change in excess entanglement entropy is proportional to the relative rapidity of the mirror in the future and in the past. And so that's the case where the state of the field is not exactly the same as it was in the past, although the evolution is perfectly unitary. So I propose this as an example of a unitary but acyclic transformation. So if acyclic transformations can exist, then we might ask, well, what would cyclicity then imply? If cyclicity is not granted, corresponds to a subsystem, a subset of all possible states, and it's interesting to ask whether cyclicity as an assumption would have consequences on the evaporation process. So slide 22. I'll introduce an observable at future infinity to investigate this question. That observable is the outgoing energy flux. So here I denote it F. You can think of it as the expectation value of some component of the energy momentum tensor in the in vacuum state, so the state that one prepares in the past as the vacuum state. And that outgoing flux has the effect of decreasing the bonding mass of the black hole. So the second line shows the bonding mass as a function of retarded time and outgoing flux. And not here is the mass or initial mass of the black hole. Now, in the 2D approximation that I've discussed previously, an exact expression is given for that outgoing flux as the Schwarzian derivative of a function p, which is defined as the so-called ray tracing mapping. And from our perspective, we should just think that 1 over p dot is the redshift factor, so that p is a function that measures redshift in space-time. And there is an exact expression for the outgoing flux in 2D as a function of that function. That expression was obtained by Fulling, Davis, and Unruh in 76.
This is for the moving mirror?
This is for the moving mirror or for any two-dimensional model of an evaporating black hole. Whatever the geometry, so this is not assuming that this two-dimensional geometry is Schwarzschild or close to Schwarzschild. This is the relationship, the general relationship between redshift and outgoing flux in the space.
A little bit louder, please.
Yep, I'll try. Thank you. So on slide 23, I'm writing down in an expression that connects this outgoing flux, F, with excess entanglement entropy defined previously as the difference between entanglement entropy in the state and in the vacuum. So excess entanglement entropy is denoted S in this expression. And S dot, again, denotes a derivative with respect to retarded time, so with respect to U. So there is this identity that holds, and from this identity, one can derive consequences. And so the remainder of the talk will be deriving consequences of this identity as far as the evaporation process is concerned under some assumptions. So the first consequence of this identity is that the Page curve, or the curve that gives entanglement between the past and the future in the field, directly determines the energy flux. So you see that the left-hand side here is directly given as some function of the right-hand side, which is entropy. Vice versa, if we know the energy flux for all times, we can integrate this equation and get the Page curve, S of U, either directly from the Riccati equation that's on the first line or through a rewriting of this equation as the Schrödinger equation through a change of variable phi equals e to the 6x. So it's clear from this rewriting that initial conditions for entanglement entropy as well as the data of the flux completely determine the state phi in this Schrödinger equation, and that state phi is, like I said, nothing but the exponential of entanglement entropy, and so we can solve for entanglement entropy. This equation is also useful as far as intuition is concerned, because as you can see, the flux acts as a potential in a Schrödinger equation, and so in a Schrödinger equation for a zero energy state, you see that the right-hand side is zero, and so whenever the flux is positive, what we have is a potential barrier, and whenever the flux is negative, what we have is a potential well. And experience in quantum mechanics provides us with intuition as to how this equation behaves. Several immediate consequences of this fact is, first of all, that not every function of U can be a flux. The existence of solutions to the Schrödinger equation above means that the flux function should be a very particular kind of function of U called an exceptional function in the scattering theory. So what this means is a generic perturbation of a flux function is typically not going to be a flux function. So in other words, the mass loss rates for an evaporating black hole, well, they're special. They're not just any function of time. Another consequence of this is the quantum inequality that bounds the duration of negative energy processes. So it might be that the black hole evaporates negatively. So from this Schrödinger equation, it's immediate to derive the quantum inequality bounding the duration of that phase, the duration tau of that phase. So this is just another perspective on the notion of quantum inequalities, which are well known. They have been investigated by Larry Ford and collaborators over 40 years. So it's just to show you that in this two-dimensional context, it's very clear where this quantum inequality comes from. But what we really want to know is consequences for evaporation. And so turning to slide number 24, we get back to black hole and black hole physics and observe that the equation relating energy flux and entanglement entropy, which I sometimes call the it from bit equation for reasons that are pretty clear. The left-hand side is energy, so it's it. The right-hand side is entropy, so it's bit. So might be called the it from bit equation. So I want to claim that this equation, although it's different in a different way, captures and generalizes the contents of the so-called generalized second law of Bekenstein. So first of all, note that this equation includes what we call non-adiabatic terms. So on the right-hand side, the second derivative of S is a non-adiabatic term. And so it is the presence of this term which means that we have an identity here between energy flux and entropy rather than an inequality. So let me recall that the generalized second law is the statement that the generalized entropy, which is the entropy of the black hole, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole, plus the entropy of matter coupled to that black hole, can never decrease in a physical process. This is a statement of Bekenstein's generalized second law. To derive this generalized second law, one needs to make assumptions about the causal structure of space-time. In particular, there should be an event horizon. This is not the case here. This identity, again, is true whether there is an event horizon or there isn't. So it's more general than the second law in that sense. But of course, it does give back the generalized second law in the non-adiabatic limit when the second term on the right-hand side is much smaller than the first term. So indeed, for a Vidaya or Schwarzschild black hole, we computed previously the entanglement entropy rate S dot as proportional to 1 over the mass. And of course, the flux can be seen to be given by the variation of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy divided by mass. And so if one combines the variation of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole plus the variation of the entanglement entropy of the field as seen from future infinity, one finds that it is given by this positive expression here that you see on the last line. And so here, of course, you see U on the numerator. So the origin of U has been chosen at the beginning of the evaporation process so that the right-hand side is indeed positive. And one finds that just like the generalized second law states, we have that the growth of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy plus entanglement entropy is positive. So from that, in that sense, from that perspective, the identity at the top of the slide implies, in a way, the physical statement of the generalized second law. But again, it's slightly more general. I, of course, acknowledge that the generalized second law is formulated in a different way, involving the entropy outside the horizon rather than the excess entanglement entropy at future infinity. Still, I would claim that the physical content is captured by this equation. On slide 25, I derive an obvious other consequence of the it from bit equation. Consider Page's conjecture that evaporation is cyclic, that entanglement entropy in the field goes back to its initial value. So this is what you're seeing with the black curve on the left-hand side for the Page curve, going up, having a maximum, and then going down again. So if that's the case, then at the Page time, entanglement entropy has a maximum. And so if it has a maximum, S dot will be exactly zero, and S double dot will be negative at that time. And so we see that from the it from bit equation, it implies that the flux at this particular time must be negative. And so that is to say that energy is not outgoing from the black hole at this particular time, at least, or in a neighborhood of this particular time. Instead, energy is ingoing to the black hole, and so we should expect the bony mass of the black hole to transiently grow again before perhaps starting decreasing again and reaching zero, if that is the assumption at final time. So Eugenio and I have called this the last gap, gas phenomenon, in analogy with what happens when somebody dies. It's been observed that somebody who dies sometimes has an inhale reflex before dying, and so just before it dies, just before a black hole dies, energy goes into the black hole rather than monotonically coming out of the black hole. More than a prediction, this effect is displayed here as a surprising, perhaps, consequence of cyclicity, and it illustrates my claim that focusing on general properties of outgoing radiation, like cyclicity, one can derive features of the evaporation process that go beyond the adiabatic phase rather than having to get them. Moving on to slide 26, I'll tell you about another consequence of cyclicity, of this assumption of cyclicity, and that's one that pertains to the time scales involved in the evaporation process. So here I'm sketching again the shape of the Page curve under the assumption that the evaporation is cyclic, meaning that the final value of S is the same as its initial value. So from semi-classical computations, we know that in a first phase, the entropy will grow almost linearly. And then, of course, if the evaporation is cyclic, there will have to be a maximum for this curve. At this maximum, I just claim that the black hole will gasp. Then a purification phase will come that will take the entropy down to zero again, down to its initial value again. So if I define tau H to be the duration of the Hawking phase, that is, from the beginning of evaporation until the process is not adiabatic anymore, until it's not the case that the S double dot term can be neglected with respect to the S dot squared term. And everything that comes after the end of the adiabatic phase, this time U1, until entropy goes back to zero, I call purification phase, and its duration I denote tau P here. So if we go to slide 27, I claim that it is very easy to see from the if from bit equation that if the process is cyclic, just like I just said, and energy is conserved so that the bondi mass remains positive, there is not more energy coming out of the black hole than was put into the black hole in the first place, then the purification time must be large. In the sense of this inequality here, where M0 is the initial mass of the black hole, M1 is the mass that remains at the end of the Hawking phase, at the end of the adiabatic phase, and MP is the Planck mass. We don't know when the adiabatic phase will end. It might be when the black hole becomes Planckian in mass, and that's the first line of the right-hand side, or maybe when the black hole is still macroscopic, say at some finite fraction of the initial mass, that's the second line. But in any case, the expression that we obtain for the purification phase goes like either the fourth power of the initial mass in Planck units or the third power. And in any case, those are very long time scales, extremely long time scales. So what this says is purification, if it is going to happen in the sense of a cyclic process and preserve energy along the way, then it will have to be extremely slow. So this is an insight that Collis and Willy had back in 87, and that can be made precise using the it from bit equation. Now, there have been a number of proposals for non-singular models of black hole evaporation, in the spirit, perhaps, of the Ashtekar-Boyovald paradigm, where space-time is assumed to be non-singular and to be described by an effective metric in a large portion that perhaps excludes the immediate vicinity of the 2B singularity, but apart from there, is well described by a semi-classical metric. So such proposals have been discussed a long time ago by Frolov and Volkovitsky, and more recently by Sean Hayward, as well as by Bardeen, James Bardeen, Carlo, Francesca, and Hall in 2014, some other authors that I have not cited here. So those models, they tend to produce a very fast purification phase where all the information comes out in a burst. In particular, when one assumes that the core of the black hole has an effectively de-Sitter geometry, this has the effect of focusing ingoing geodesics in the neighborhood of the core, and when the apparent horizon disappears and information starts leaking out of the black hole, that neighborhood of the core produces a burst that is very short in time, and that, I claim, is not consistent with cyclicity and energy conservation, because it's too short, and the bound just above demands that purification time be large.
Matteo, can I ask a question?
For sure.
I wonder, I mean, in the case considered by Carlo and Hall, in which you have a bouncing black hole, it seems to me that the process is totally not adiabatic, and I wonder how could it be possible to apply the considerations about the purifications in this case.
Okay.
I mean, the process is totally dominated by something that is not the Hawking evaporation. The Hawking evaporation is just a small effect over another dominating process. So why should I care about what you are presenting
right.
in that case?
Right. Thank you, Francesca. So the point is that the it from bit equation holds in the adiabatic phase, the Hawking phase, as well as in the future of that phase. Okay, so this is the beauty of this argument, where I derive consequences of a global assumption on the page curve that is not restricted to a semi-classical phase where space-time is almost Schwarzschild and Hawking evaporation is slow. So this is the first observation. The second observation is that I'm claiming here that it is probably not possible, at least within the approximations that I've made, and that's the best that I can tell you about right now, to say that Hawking, the Hawking effect and what comes after is negligible. I'm saying what comes after that Hawking phase, even if it by itself takes a very slow amount of mass from the black, a very little amount of mass from the black hole, what comes after will take a huge amount of mass from the black hole. In fact, more than there is. And so I take this inequality as suggesting that it is probably not correct or not consistent to claim that quantum effects are small, negligible with respect to the classical bound. I think they say quantum friction, the reaction of the quantum field to this bound is not small, it's large, and it is going to affect the space-time geometry so much that something else than the bound will happen. At least that's my understanding. It's the best of my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Colin.
Matteo, I have a question. In the model with Hall, the duration of the entire process is not m cubed, it's m squared. That's the hypothesis.
Yeah.
So the large entropy that it's supposed to build up in the page scenario just doesn't have the time to build up.
Yeah, right. But so it is an assumption in your model that the Hawking phase is much shorter than usually expected. So it goes like m squared, like you say, instead of m cubed. But then the purification phase is still very, very short. And so you're quite right that it's a slightly different framework than the normal assumption where Hawking evaporation is m cubed. But still, in this case, I claim that there is too much energy involved for the black hole to consistently bounce in this way.
The energy at infinity, it's in that scenario, I mean, I don't know if that scenario is right, but in that scenario, the energy at infinity is dominated by the energy of the shell which is much larger than the energy of the Hawking radiation all the time. So
I don't believe it's the case. I believe the energy that comes from exciting the vacuum in this bouncing mechanism turns out to be not smaller or much smaller than the energy in the shell, but larger. And it's not a possibility, of course. So I think the bounce is a too brutal a phenomenon when coupling the shell to the quantum field vacuum. And it's so brutal that the back reaction on the shell will have to be strong and change the picture. At least that's what I'm proposing.
But would you agree that if suppose some phenomenon we don't know would disrupt a black hole in a very, very short time?
Yeah.
Some physics we don't know. Then the entire Hawking radiation would be irrelevant. Wouldn't you think so?
Right. So there's the Hawking radiation, which is the first phase where entanglement entropy in the field grows linearly. And then there's whatever comes after that. So those are two things that we should distinguish. It might very well be that the energy taken by Hawking radiation itself is small, but then what comes after can be big, too big even. And this is what I'm claiming is the case in your proposal.
Aren't you just here considering the energy of the Hawking radiation to be sort of the order of magnitude of the energy of the hole itself? Isn't that part of your scenario?
It is.
Or not? You have M1, you have M0, you don't have another parameter there.
Yeah, so no, this is correct. So this bound here, the left-hand side of the bound, is general and makes no assumption on M1. Now, if M1 is of the order, at least, of the mass of the black hole, like you say, then you get this cubic scaling. Now I'm claiming something else, which is in the model of a bouncing black hole, it is not because of this bound directly that we have a problem. It's just the details of how the bounce occurs so fast. This, a computation, which I cannot report, unfortunately, because it's not out, a computation shows that the energy involved is way larger than the mass of the black hole, which is an inconsistency.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I cannot present a paper to support this claim. It is just a claim at this point. I'm hoping that in the future a paper will come and support this claim with a computation.
Sure. And another question is related to that. Are you assuming that the quantum field theorem and curved space-time approximation is sort of valid all over inside the black hole as well? There's no region where it fails by itself. Is that one of your assumptions?
I didn't understand, Carlo. Can you repeat?
Are you assuming that inside the black hole, the bouncy black hole or whatever, the approximation given by quantum field theorem curved space-time is still valid with some geometry? That's one of the assumptions, is it?
Not necessarily. So this is describing here the state of the field as perceived from far, and there are proposals where the geometry is semi-classical outside the space-time to a good approximation, but perhaps not inside. So this is what one finds, for instance, in CGHS models. This is work by Abai and collaborators showing that there exists to a very good approximation, the semi-classical geometry outside the hole. Inside the hole, fluctuations are large, but they are confined there. So,
but the relation you get between the entropy time evolution and the energy time evolution, it's derived from quantum field theory in two dimensions by assuming that there is a model that corresponds to what happened inside. I mean, the P curve, it's computed from what happened inside, not just the physics outside, obviously, because from an internal region, in principle, everything could come out unless you have a control of it. You have a control of it because you're assuming that there is a two-dimensional model quantum field theory that you can use to connect entropy at infinity and energy at infinity, isn't it?
Outside the hole. The quantum fluctuations inside the hole, they might be large, and indeed they are in this case of two dimensions, the CGHS case. But still, the two-dimensional effective field theory picture holds to a good approximation outside the hole. And perhaps I should let Abhay either confirm or disagree here, because those are computations that he made with collaborators.
But I don't understand. How do you know what comes up out of the white hole? I mean, how does your calculation know about those modes? Hello?
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good question.
Can you use this button?
Yeah, Lee?
Mateo, in trying to distinguish between your scenario and Carlo and collaborators, they have a proposal for the fate of the singularity. Do you have a proposal for the fate of the singularity because your whole treatment is relating quantities outside the apparent horizon, and therefore you don't seem to touch the issue of the fate of the singularity? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm afraid we didn't get that very well. Nobody in the room understood what you said, unfortunately.
I understood what Lee said, and I also would like to sort of comment on what was said before. So Lee is asking that in the proposal of Planck's stars, in the scenario of Planck's stars, there's a proposal for what happens to the singularity. There is some specific idea about the geometry there. And the question Lee was asking is, in your calculations, are you also explicitly or implicitly assuming about what happens to the singularity? So let me just stop here and then come back to CGHS in a minute.
No, the answer is no, and that's what I think is the strength of this approach, where instead of having to guess, like I said, the nature of back reaction deep into the back hole, one can come up with those generic conclusions that are just based on assuming, say, cyclicity. So I think the answer is no.
It could be that.
Hello?
But not using this job because I cannot.
We cannot hear you.
Okay. There's too much. Can people use a microphone using it?
Is anybody able to hear?
No, we cannot.
There's too much static.
So the chair here, Aldo, is saying that there is no point in calling back.
Now we can hear you. Now we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Are we back? Okay, good. Great. So I think Abhay was having a second question, I think.
I can either say things or you can just finish and then we can have a discussion. You mentioned about CGHS and it's related to the issues that Carlo was raising about what happens.
Okay, I'll finish
night.
And I'll be happy to hear your views.
Okay, why don't you finish?
Okay, so on slide 28, this is the sort of the status of those arguments in two dimensions. One can either start from a semi-classical space-time that might not be static, that might be dynamical and include some back reaction effects, and then derive from it the evaporation mass law. For instance, in two dimensions, that would amount to using the Fulling-Davis-Unruh formula, or go for the page curve using those inputs from Holtze, Larsen, and Wolczek, and perhaps along the lines that Eugenio, Tommaso, and myself showed in this paper in 2014. We also saw that there is a direct connection between the page curve and the mass law, at least in two dimensions once more. But the missing link in my mind is the reverse problem, where one tries and constrain the mass law or the page curve and gets to to a semi-classical spacetime corresponding to those constraints. So to a partial extent, that's what, say, the black hole gasping phenomenon is about. One starts from an assumption about energy conservation and cyclicity of entanglement, and one finds this consequence about the black hole spacetime where it has to gasp at some point. But I would really like to go beyond this sort of first step and understand whether, for instance, there exists a non-singular black hole spacetime in which evaporation is cyclic, but also conservative in the sense that the mass that comes out is not more than the mass that goes in. This, I think, is an open question, and it's an important one. Sort of a related question is, what kind of spacetime does Page's curve describe? The Page curve has been used in arguments in the literature for a long time. So by Page curve, I mean cyclic evaporation with a maximum at the Page time. Well, is there a spacetime that has this as entanglement entropy curve, or isn't there? I don't know, and I would like to know. So from that perspective, it's a bit of an inverse problem where one starts from features of the field to guess something of the black hole spacetime. A little bit like in scattering theory where you send particles on an object, and from the outgoing data, you can infer sometimes some features of the scatterer. A little bit the same, I think, is perhaps possible in the black hole problem. And I'll give you my conclusions on the next slide, 29. Here I have argued in favor of an approach where one focuses on asymptotic observers, and that's us. And the main reason for this approach is because this is how we get a chance perhaps to find predictions or physical effects that might be observable from us rather than from the perspective of Alice falling into a black hole. I think that's the most interesting perspective. I claim that in field theory, because of the infinite number of modes, unitarity is not the same as cyclicity. To say that the state of the field is pure at scribe plus is not the same as claiming that entanglement in the field is the same in the future and in the past. So it's interesting to make this distinction. I showed that in some cases, if you guess a dynamical geometry, then you can compute the Page curve in the sense of having an exact computation rather than hand-waving arguments. But of course, once more, this requires inputting back reaction as a starting point. And I think the inverse problem is insightful as well, perhaps even more insightful, where you can use arguments such as the it from bit equation connecting energy output and entanglement to derive consequences for the structure of a black hole from general constraints, rather than having to guess once more about the effect of back reaction on the geometry, whether it is going to produce a de Sitter core or a bouncing phenomenon and so forth. Instead of having to guess, perhaps you can sort of somehow put constraints on possible behaviors, taking into account the fact that the black hole is an object that will couple to a quantum field, and that will have physical effects. So this is the beginning of a program, perhaps, of taking the inverse perspective on black hole problems. Thank you for your attention, and I thank Abai, Eugenio Tomago, Alejandro Calo, and many others for very useful conversations on this topic. Thank you all.
Questions?
Okay, so maybe I should just say start by answering things that Matteo raised. So in the CGHS model, there are a couple of things. First is that it is done in a self-consistent way, so that the back reaction is actually included, and one is not assuming anything about, one is not assuming that the back reaction is small or large, one is just including it and seeing what happens. However, the back reaction of the Hawking evaporation process, there is again, in the semi-classical, as Carlo was saying, if one uses semi-classical approximation, there is still a singularity. It's a weak singularity where the metric is actually continuous, but still the curvature blows up. So in the semi-classical space-time, we do have a weak singularity, and therefore there is also the last ray, such as in such as in one of Matteo's slides, very referred to. Let me just see which slide it is. It was there was a last ray somewhere. Yeah, on the slide 16, there is a last ray. Or maybe not 16. Just one second. Slide 17. There is a last ray there. So the basically one is really looking at that portion of the space-time, which is to the past of I plus in the slide 17, the left-hand side figure. And then the statement is that the back reaction is included and everything, and one gets a self-consistent solution. One is not assuming what is happening inside. But of course, Carlo's question is, well, but if you want to know what happens to the future, then one needs to know what happens to this singularity, this quantum geometry, etc. Now, even in CGHS, and I believe this is the main point that Mathieu is making in the more general context, that one can draw certain conclusions without knowing the details of how the singularity is resolved and so on, just looking at the outgoing state and making hypotheses like, in fact, the entropy does go to zero. There are these relations between the entanglement entropy and the fluxes, and no matter what your process is, so long as the notion of body energy is well-defined and the fluxes are well-defined, the statement is that certain conclusions can be drawn. And as I understand it from what Matthew is saying, is that the detailed calculations, which he said are not yet published, are indicating that somehow if one assumes the scenario in which the Hawking evaporation is much longer than some other processes, then there can be a contradiction just looking at what happens at null infinity. So this is what I understand, and Matteo can comment and correct and so on.
Yeah, that's what I'm claiming, exactly.
I don't remember if I said or not, but in CGHS models, the detailed calculations have explicitly shown that the Stewart-Hawking thunderbolt, which is the picture I was looking at in slide 17, is incorrect. In fact, there is no thunderbolt. In fact, the geometry there on that last ray is completely fine, and therefore one can actually, the curvature doesn't blow up there at all, so it is physically plausible that geometry can be continued if one had a better theory of quantum gravity. And the point that we, the detailed calculations with CGHS were done in a couple of papers with Franz Pretorius and Fethi Raman Azoglu. But before that, there was a paper with Madhavan Varadarajan and Tavares, Victor Tavares, in which we had done the analytical part. And there, we had also shown in CGHS that irrespective of what is coming out, irrespective of what is happening in the singularity, so to say, so long as you make some plausible assumptions at infinity, you can draw some conclusions. The conclusions that Mathieu is drawing are stronger.
Other comments or questions?
Since everybody's silent, I have one more comment, and this really comes from Amos Ori, who has thought about this quite a lot, and I have had some correspondence recently with him about this work that Mathieu and Eugenio and others are doing.
Who? Sorry?
The correspondence is from Amos Ori, who is in Israel and who has thought about this problem quite a lot over the years. So his comments are twofold. The first is a comment that I have made before, which is that it may look harmless, but there is an assumption, which is that the not only are the more spherical symmetric, that's what one is focusing here, but in addition to that, one is assuming that the back reaction, back scattering can be neglected. What I mean is the following, that if I had a four-dimensional space-time, and if I did a dimensional reduction, then I still get a certain potential for the test fields which are actually propagating in the RT plane. And that potential is being neglected in this calculation. And that assumption may particularly not be so good in the late stages of evaporation, where what is coming out is presumably very long-length modes. So this is something that I'm most uncomfortable about with this calculation that Matteo presented today. But Amos Ori brought out a second point, which is really the assumption that this one can do things just with this. Not only is there a classical metric outside some central region, but in fact one can describe the whole processes using these null rays. And as I understand it, his concern is basically that the what is coming out is extremely high wave is extremely long wavelength, and therefore, again, because of this, the kind of anything like a null tracing of null rays would just not capture, or would not at all faithfully capture what is happening to the propagation of these waves at late times. And in particular, he believes that if one took that into account, then this conclusion such as there must be a little negative energy flux and so on might actually go away. So there are these two assumptions. In some sense, they are the same assumption. But particularly at the last stages, it seems maybe one cannot really just use this ray tracing and ignore the back scattering because the wavelengths would be rather large compared to the background curvature.
So I completely agree with Abhay and Amos Ori that this is a main outstanding question, and really there is a question mark here regarding backscattering. I entirely agree, and I'm looking forward to investigating this deeper.
More comments or questions? If not, let's thank Matteo again.